This is the current federal tax developments for the week of July 30th, 2018. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by the Kaplan Professional Education and your State Society of CPAs. This week, we're going to take a look at the following items coming up. First, we have the first set of 199 CAPA regulations now have officially been sent to the Office of Management and Budget. We'll talk about what that means and when maybe we can expect to see them. We'll talk about a couple of states. Again, Wayfair continues, and that's going to keep happening for a while here. First, the state of Minnesota this week announced that they're going to test whether they can go lower than South Dakota for purposes of a de minimis test. So we'll talk about how low Minnesota is going and also maybe how low a state could go in this case. The state of Utah decided not to try that. They had a special session and enacted the South Dakota limits. So in the state of Utah, we now have the South Dakota limits are going to take effect there. We're going to talk about another United States District Court case. This one agreed with the IRS's own regulations, limits how much the IRS can charge as a willfulness penalty for an FBAR violation. And finally, we're going to talk with a taxpayer who ended up losing when the case went to the Ninth Circuit regarding whether they had transferee liability on a transaction that was set up to allow them to sell their C corporation stock and end up, or actually sell their C corporation assets, then have another party buy the stock and get paid more than they would have received had the C corp paid the tax. And the problem becomes when it turns out that the entity that bought the shares from them never paid the tax, was their transferee liability. The tax court had said no twice. The Ninth Circuit this time says, sorry guys, there is transferee liability. But let's start out with the good news. Let's go on and take a look at the fact that the Office of Management and Budget has received the 199 CAPA regulations, some of them. This information was posted on the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs website on July the 23rd. And what we found there was a title there for an entry that said guidance under section 199 CAPA, and then in parentheses says computational. Now, right now, that is all we know about these regs. They are regulations. They are comes under the ruling or the agreement that Treasury and the Office of Management and Budget had that they will review these particular TCJA regulations will be reviewed no more than 10 business days. So we're going to have 10 days. The Office of Management and Budget is reviewing the regs. Prior to this year, OMB did not review Treasury regulations. They had been exempted from OMB's review. That was changed this year. There was a fight involved. Treasury still doesn't like it. In fact, the Treasury Secretary still, I guess right now, he makes happy. But the idea is that he wasn't terribly thrilled about this either. Doesn't matter. It is in OMB. And we're going to see how quickly they go. Now, we reminded you in the past that OMB still didn't have anybody who knew taxes on board. Hopefully, by now, they've got somebody there. It's a little bit questionable about how much usefulness you can have for guidance if you don't really know how the taxes work. The 10-day period will end on August the 3rd. Now, the question is going to be how quickly after that do we get regulations? And these are not going to be final. These are proposed regulations. How quickly will we get them in the Federal Register? Well, we have some guidance now. We just finished the 10-day period, and the OMB has sent back to the IRS basically, apparently with approval, the regulations under 965 that they were going to issue as proposed. Those regulations have not, as of yet, made an appearance or an announcement they'll be appearing in the Federal Register. It's been a couple of days. So I would suggest that probably it will be sometime next week, we'll hope, that we'll actually get our first glance at the CAPA regs. Note that the IRS has said pretty much openly that there's not just going to be one set of these regs, that there will be additional 199 CAPA projects coming along. What we're hoping for in this set, though, will be things like, can we combine activities into a single business? You know, how that goes. Probably not going to get specified service here. I mean, that kind of tough to see how that works in computational, but maybe it does. We'll just have to see how that's going to work. But nevertheless, we expect to see more coming down the pike, but at least this will give us something to get started with when we see the proposed regs. We're also going to have to watch them carefully to see if these proposed regs are ones we're allowed to rely upon, or if they're going to be ones that, well, this is what Treasury's thinking, but if they don't go with this, you committed to what they have now, they decide something different. Will you be able to still use what you had, what was in the proposed regs for this year? Watch carefully when these regs come out, whether we can rely upon them, at least for this year's taxes. Next issue up, let's talk about the states. The Wayfair case continues to ripple through the economy and through the various states. The state of Minnesota posted an announcement this week. The Minnesota Department of Revenue posted a news release on the 25th of July. That news release tells us that the state of Minnesota will start enforcing its existing remote seller law on October the 1st of 2018. So that means if you are selling into Minnesota and you trip the minimums, you must start collecting that sales tax and remitting it to the state of Minnesota on the 1st of October. Now, Minnesota uses a rule that looks at the prior 12 months. The first time you have 12 consecutive months where you exceed one or the other of the two limits, then the following month, you've got to start collecting and remitting the sales tax. So obviously, you'll start tracking if your client's close to these limits. They need to start keeping careful count and figure out probably during the month in question, the prior month, if it looks like they're going over, and get ready to do the collection. That'll be the way it works. Now, Minnesota did not go with South Dakota's rules. They've kept their own rules that are in their code. First, there are two tests. Like South Dakota, $100,000 in sales will get you in, but only if you have at least 10 transactions. So the good news is in Minnesota, let's say that I sell large pieces of equipment that are taxable to whoever's buying them in Minnesota, and I make one sale there that's $130,000. I will not have to collect sales tax in Minnesota because that single $130,000 sale doesn't push me over the limit. I need to have nine more within the 12-month period, nine more sales of some sort before I'll finally have to do collections. South Dakota, the single $125,000 sale would push you into the collection regime. But secondly, this one is a little bit worse. And in fact, I think for most of our taxpayers, this is the limit they're really going to be looking at. If you have at least 100 separate transactions into Minnesota, no matter what the size of those transactions, then you have to collect. So if your client's invoice amounts are less than $1,000, so that, you know, generally their average invoice is less than $1,000, then most likely they're going to trip first over the 100 transaction limits. A lot more businesses, I would say, especially those selling to consumers, are going to trip over the 100 transaction limitation, not the $1,000 in sales, because again, unless you have an average invoice of over $1,000, the transaction limit will be your problem. South Dakota allows you 200 transactions, Minnesota only 100. So Minnesota will kick in earlier. Now, one piece of good news, they are a streamlined sales and use tax agreement state. That means that, yes, you can get your license from Minnesota along with the other streamlined sales and use tax states. That also means that as far as the Supreme Court was concerned, that's a good thing for Minnesota. Minnesota's also not looking retroactive. That's a good thing. A key question we've got to look at here, though, is the fact that Minnesota went to half of South Dakota's standard on transactions, will that be considered to be an impermissible burden? Well, here's the practical problem. Maybe it would succeed. Maybe you could go to court. Maybe you could get it thrown out. But my guess is if you have 250 transactions, the fact that you were tripped at 100, they're probably not going to let you out because 200 would be high enough, and so therefore you weren't harmed. The catch is, if I only have 100 transactions in Minnesota, if I fight Minnesota, I'm going to have to pay for the court cost to defend those 100,000 transactions, which are less, those 100 transactions, which are less than 100,000 in revenue. It's going to pretty quickly become far more expensive to fight Minnesota than to challenge, than to just go along. My guess is for most clients, we're going to have to advise them that probably if they trip the 100 transaction limits in Minnesota, they better assume it's time to go start collecting the sales tax. Because, you know, I'm sure while all the other people around the country would love it if they took Minnesota to court and won, they're probably not going to make money by doing that. Next up, the state of Utah Utah called a special session, and they adopted Utah Senate Bill 2001, which came in on July the 19th. It's been signed into law now by the governor of Utah. And what this bill does is adopt South Dakota's triggers. So again, you're looking at the this one, not 100 transactions, 200 transactions, or $100,000 worth of sales. That's exactly the level of numbers that the Supreme Court Justice Kennedy approved in South Dakota. The collection date is not October 1st. That's a little bit more good news. This will be on January 1st of 19. Not like that's not really coming up quick, but at least it gives you a few more months to work besides the October date that a lot of states are going to. So there's the other piece of good news. One piece of bad news, though, if you've been voluntarily collecting sales tax for Utah and you're an out-of-state seller, turns out they're going to eliminate the 18% reduction. Under prior Utah law, through the end of 18, if you basically did not have physical presence in Utah, but you voluntarily agreed to collect the sales and use tax, you were essentially able to keep 18% of what you collected. So in essence, the state paid you to do it. That payment to do it is going to be eliminated as of the first of the year. So if you have a client who's been making use of that 18% reduction in Utah for voluntary compliance, that's coming to an end when the mandatory collections come in. The other thing is, please remember, Utah is a streamlined sales and use tax member state. Because of that, again, we can apply all at one point. But secondly, Utah is pretty much on all fours versus what South Dakota had, and which Justice Kennedy decided looked pretty good to him. So my guess is Utah's cases, I think you're going to have a lot less success, I think people will, in attempting to challenge Utah's bill. Again, maybe somebody's got a creative way to do it. Maybe there's somehow to bring this in. But right now, it seems like Utah, most likely in Utah, you're going to have to actually collect and pay over the sales tax if you trip the triggers for the state of Utah. Next up, the IRS loses again. A second court tells the IRS you never updated your regs. Tough luck. This is Walden versus United States. This is a Colorado District Court case. Case number 1:17CV01287, issued on July the 19th of 2018. This is a case that, just like the case earlier, Colliott case in Texas, this is a taxpayer who willfully violated the FBAR reporting rules. That's not a question here. They have willful violation. However, under the law, generally, you know, the Congress changed the law back in 2004, and they said if you willfully violate the FBAR regulations, the IRS can impose a maximum penalty, at the greater of $100,000 or 50% of the balance in the account. Now, that could be nasty because obviously if you violate FBAR for 1 year, you probably violate it for multiple. And if you keep giving up 50% of the account, you know, after 2 years, you may very well not have an account left because the penalties, and you may be paying more of a penalty than you have in the account once we get to year three. So basically, you know, that would be expensive. However, the prior law only had a $100,000 penalty. The regulations the IRS has under this provision of the law were never updated. The IRS regulations still reference a maximum penalty of $100,000. Now, here's where it gets to be a problem. The taxpayer in this case said, okay, fine, they can penalize me, but they can't go for 50% of the account. All they can do maximum is hit me with a $100,000 penalty because they haven't changed the reg. The reg says the penalty is $100,000. The law says the maximum penalty the IRS can impose is $100,000. They're saying, we read that as giving the IRS discretion to set a lower penalty. So they don't have to do 50% of the account. They could say it's going, you know, the penalty is going to be will be no more than $100,000, which is what the reg currently says. So the taxpayer says, yeah, you know what? We owe this, but we only owe $100,000. We don't owe 50% of the penalty, 50% of the account for each year in question. The court here in Colorado agreed with the earlier decision we talked about, Colliott in Texas, the Western District of Texas. U.S. District Court had also said, IRS, you've never updated the reg. The reg is not inconsistent with the law. And you can't just say, well, Congress clearly meant for the bigger penalties to apply. Congress didn't say the penalty shall be the greater of $100,000 or 50% of the account. They just said the maximum penalty. That maximum gives you discretion. Your regulation, as written right now, would use that discretion to reduce it. Congress has never visited the law to say, no, we meant maximum. Court said, sorry, guys, you know, as long as that reg reads the way it does, the most you're going to get on this is $100,000. This is interesting because we now have a second court in a second court of appeals district. So if the IRS appeals this, we could end up having it going in two different circuits, or more likely the IRS will try to figure out which circuit's more favorable. Would they prefer to hear this in the 10th or the 5th? We'll see. I would put my bet on the 10th, but nevertheless, you know, they could go in the 5th. It depends. The 5th on FBAR might actually work for them. We'll just have to see. In any event, we've got to see what the IRS does. Do they actually go ahead and try to get an overruling of these opinions in the courts of appeal, or do they go back and try to redo a new regulation project and simply have the rate conform to what Congress said in 2004? It's interesting, but obviously, for now, it looks like the IRS is going to have trouble. That'll be especially true if we get a couple more courts to throw in with the $100,000 limitation. Our final issue this week looks at a case of transferee liability. And this case, which actually is an Arizona case, is Sloan versus Commissioner from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, case number 16-73349 on July the 24th. This was a case where the tax court had ruled that the taxpayer did not have transferee liability in this case, but for the second time, the Ninth Circuit overturned the decision. The last time they overturned it, said, tax court, you didn't consider the right test. Go consider it. This time the court said, well, we considered it. We still don't see transferee liability. Now the Ninth Circuit said, sorry, guys, there's transferee liability. Now, what was the structure here? The structure here was what was essentially a marketed program. And this particular program, which was marketed to a lot of taxpayers, we've seen a bunch of cases like this over the years. You know, we've had a number of cases that have come down using this structure that was used in the case of Sloan. The taxpayer owned, in this case, it was a broadcasting company that had a lot of radio licenses and all that sort of thing. So this broadcasting company went to sell out to a larger competitor. As I recall, it was Citadel that was buying them. They turned around and basically sold their assets to Citadel. Now they're a C corp, so obviously this is going to create a problem. There's going to be a gain inherent inside the C corp, right, which will be taxable. Then secondly, there's going to be a gain imposed on them when they sell their stock. This was not a 1202 company. It's going to end up being stuck with, you know, having to pay the double tax. That double tax was always our problem with a C corp, right? C corps may work great. They're great at building capital because the rates had always been lower than individuals. Now, by the way, they're much lower than individuals. But the problem is when you try to get out or you try to get funds out, they're not so great for that. What happened in this case was, though, their accountant got a flyer from an organization that says, you know what? We can solve problems for people that have this sort of C corp big gain inside, and we can go ahead and we can eliminate that tax. What we do, we have this program where we can take that, the income from that, and we can offset it with losses that we're going to generate in this new corporation. And so we will get rid of your tax liability. And because of that, we're going to get rid of that liability. We can pay you more than for your stock, for the stock of a corporation has a big tax liability attached to it. We're going to pay you more than the balance of the cash in that company reduced by the tax you'd have to pay. Because obviously the only money coming out would be the money net of tax. So we'll give you more money and we'll get rid, therefore, effectively of a significant portion of that first level of tax. Now the taxpayer said, okay. So the accountant came to the taxpayer, said, I got this marketing, and it seems like something that would solve your problem. I don't know much about it, but do you want me to look into it? The taxpayer said, well, yeah, we owe a lot of tax. Please look into this. The accountant then brought in an attorney. And by the way, and then one of the owners brought in another attorney. So we have two attorneys and the accountant looking at this transaction. In looking over the transactions, they made inquiries of the buyer. And they asked the buyer, but basically, is this legit? Are you going to buy? And they said, yes, we're buying the stock. Well, they said, well, that's great. If it's a stock sale, we get rid of the second tax. But we don't understand something here. How exactly are you going to get rid of that tax inside the company? Because that company still owes a ton of tax. And what the buyer said was, sorry, guys, that's a proprietary tax planning scheme or structure that we use, and we're not telling anybody how we do it. Okay, so they were basically shut down as far as learning how they would keep from paying the tax. Nevertheless, the attorney informed, both attorneys it appears, informed the corporation that basically, yeah, we don't know how they're going to get rid of this, but we don't believe you face a risk of transferee liability. Transferee liability would occur if you basically bankrupt a corporation and you bankrupt it as a shareholder, and you do so knowing that there's a huge unpaid liability. In essence, you're not allowed to do that. And Internal Revenue Code doesn't allow you to do that. And so what ends up happening in that case is you end up having the liability for the taxes transfer from the corporation to the individual shareholders who took the money out of the corporation. In this case, turned out ultimately that the buyer's magic strategy didn't work. So there was this huge unpaid tax. It also turns out that what the buyer did was took the money out of the corporation and used that to pay off the debt that had been borrowed to buy the stock from the old shareholders. So the debt stayed in the company for a very short period of time. In essence, the debt was outstanding for a short period of time, and the debt, and it was paid off immediately. They cashed it out. They took their fee. They went home. The corporation is left with no money. And ultimately, when this loss that they claimed they could take turns out not to be allowed, it's got no assets with which to pay the tax. It doesn't pay the tax. The IRS first goes against the buyer and said, you took the money, but they're bankrupt. They're unable to pay the tax. So now the court goes, so now the IRS is going back to the original sellers of Sloan, of Sloan Broadcasting, and saying, guys, you owe us the tax. The tax court had twice said, no, that wasn't the case. They said, look, these guys had asked their accountant and attorneys. They got this advice. These guys had no reason to believe the tax would not be paid. They had been advised that, this was a fine transaction. And because they didn't have bad faith, we're not going to apply the Arizona's basically statute on these fraudulent conveyances and the federal statute that would then allow the IRS to collect the money. They're going to say basically, no, sorry, there was no bad intent on the part of the sellers. And because that, by the way, there are other cases like this where the tax court has found bad intent. But they said in this case, we don't find any bad intent. This was Midcoast was the company selling these. We don't find any bad intent in this Midcoast transaction. So, there's no transferee liability. The Ninth Circuit did not agree. Now, what's concerning about how the Ninth Circuit gets here, though, is the Ninth Circuit found, primarily by looking at what the attorneys and the accountant knew, that the attorneys and the accountant were aware that they hadn't been told how the tax wouldn't be paid. The attorneys and accountants admitted that they had no idea how you could avoid this. In fact, the attorneys had said, one of them said, in his many decades of law practice in tax law, he had never seen a transaction like this, and he really had no idea how they were going to get out of paying the tax. The court said, well, you should have been on notice that there was a high likelihood the tax wouldn't be paid because you're experienced tax counsel. In essence, assuming that they had this magic pill out there that would somehow solve the problem, that's stretching it. You had reason to believe the tax wouldn't be paid. Now, what's disconcerting about that, though, was the Ninth Circuit panel then jumped ahead and said, well, the taxpayers, therefore, had noticed the tax wouldn't be paid. There are only two ways I can see to come to that conclusion. Number one, that the taxpayers should have recognized that this deal was too good to be true from the start. And so, you know, that's why they sought the advice. But, you know, when the advice didn't come back saying the tax would be paid, that should have been a red flag to them. Or number two, okay, maybe they don't understand it, which, by the way, seems more in line with the way courts have traditionally analyzed things like this. But because their advisors knew this, and there was nothing the court showed me, you know, nothing I've seen in this case suggests that the attorney and accountant told the taxpayer that, oh, by the way, we can't figure out how they're not going to pay the tax. So, you know, we don't have any idea. So we suspect maybe they're not going to pay it at all. I don't see any evidence of that. But the court, you know, the panel did basically assume that knowledge was inherent in the taxpayer. And because of that, there was fraudulent intent. That would be a very cautionary tale for CPAs and attorneys who are asked to give advice in situations. As a practical matter, first thing is it's probably best your client doesn't go through a situation like this anyway. But secondly, as I always say, be very, very leery of somebody who has a tax planning scheme that you need to sign off on where they're not telling you how it's supposed to work. You know, in essence, that's a big takeaway, I think, from this. Certainly for anybody here, and I'm in Arizona, any of us here in the Ninth Circuit, we certainly have to worry about this because this apparently is a test that at least this Ninth Circuit panel was using. So be very careful in this realm. I would hope that the courts don't generally hold taxpayers to this level of standard, meaning they're going to impute all the knowledge and skill of the advisor if you bring one in. To be totally frank, that would seem to be a position of the courts that would discourage taxpayers from seeking the advice, because apparently if you get a good advisor in and the good advisor doesn't spot something that we think they should have given their experience, well, tough luck. You know, you knew it. Yeah, dangerous position. Well, again, as I say, we finish another week. And don't forget, these are paid for. We have them existing here because of the State Society CPA courses that we do here at Capital Professional Education. Be sure and check your State Society CPA courses, the live courses coming up. Most of the states, you know, the states we talk about, are going to offer live courses. We do live courses both in tax and auditing and accounting for a number of state societies. So be sure to check your catalogs. We'd like it if you take our courses, but hey, you can find other courses you'll take too. I've taken other courses. You know, I take other courses. So, you know, but take them from the state societies. Be sure to check there. It is something, it's an environment that you don't get elsewhere. I have always found, way before I ever started doing the actual lecturing, that I always got my best guidance and my best education going to the live sessions with somebody who was up to speed. And the nice thing about the State Society people is we tend to have people that specialize in technical areas. This is the type of detailed deep dive guidance you simply cannot get from other locations and some sort of generic getting ready for tax season, broad discussion of some rather simple concepts on 1040s. We're talking about deep dives of technical topics. This is where you can find them. Speaking of such, remind you again, this Friday, we are doing the Farming and Ranching Businesses and the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act webinar for the Idaho Society. It will be August the 3rd, 4 hours, starting at 9 a.m. Mountain Daylight Time, 8 a.m. Pacific Daylight. Of course, I'm here in Phoenix, so for me, I'll start talking at 8 a.m. Mountain Standard Time. That confuses everybody, but basically same time frame. We are going to look at some of the really odd 199 CAPA and agriculture issues because, by the way, how Congress solved the grain glitch really causes some interesting quirks in ag. We'll also take a look at entity selections. Have that changed? We'll talk some about the 199 regs coming out. Can we group entities? So if we have the farming operation, multiple entity structures, will we be able to group them? We'll talk about where that'll be there. Information about signing up for this course, which you can do through Friday. Basically, I should say through Thursday. Friday morning will be a little tough. IDCPA.org is where you can find out information about that. It will be webcast. It will be 4 hours. We will have a printed book. Well, I should say PDF book. You can print it. And we'll also have the slide live presentation. You can present questions during the session. So if you have that issue, you're looking at that farming and ranching issues and just want to dive on the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act and are willing to accept, we're going to concentrate on farming and ranching examples of how they would be impacted, you can go ahead, sign up for this Friday's course. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments again for the week of July the 30th of 2018. Remember, you can catch our regular updates online at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. If you want to ask me questions, you can questions or comments. Ed Zollers at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com is where you can send the emails. You can follow me on Twitter. There I'm at Ed Zollers. I also follow discussions on the Arizona, New Jersey, and California listservs. California's tax talk is also open to anybody in the country. The Arizona, New Jersey ones are open to members in those states, so you have to be a member of the state society. But we do post questions there. Also, I check in from time to time on the Tax Pros listserv on Reddit, reddit.com/r/taxpros. Well, probably won't have the 199 cap A proposed regs next week, but we'll hope for something the following week. But I'm certainly going to have more things happening to talk about in the coming week that's developing in taxes. And I look forward to doing another week here in the area of federal taxes as we talk about the area of current federal tax developments.